It's been getting more expensive to go to college in Arizona, and this month it got even more expensive. And plenty of Arizona students aren't taking advantage of all options to pay those bills.
There's a big gap between the people who are going and are already going to go and the people who have filled out the form and taken the necessary steps to be financially ready to pay for higher education.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the latest on Sheriff Joe Arpaio's contempt of court hearing. Airports, large and small, get new technology courtesy of your federal government.
And these are the sounds of 20 miles above the earth.
There's bursts of kind of static-like sound, and then you can hear in the recording some kind of pure tone, and then a few kind of clicks and whistles.
Plus, career training takes a hit and remembering a legend of the Wild West.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-10 eastbound, an accident at 7th Street has the HOV lane blocked. On the 60 westbound, an accident at Mill has the HOV lane blocked. Look for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon today with a high of 75. Partly cloudy, slight chance of rain tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-50s. It's 65 degrees right now.
The Arizona Supreme Court has found the state is liable for a fatal accident that was a result of outdated highway design and unsafe conditions. KJZZ's Will Stone reports the High Court handed down the decision today.
In 2007, Diana Glazer and her family were driving on Interstate 10 south of Phoenix when a car in the oncoming lane swerved, causing a head-on collision. Both Glazer's husband and daughter were killed. That stretch of highway had no median barrier. Glazer then sued the state and won. After several appeals, the High Court took up the case. Under law, the state is not liable for the accident, even on a hazardous section of the road, so long as it provides a warning. That it did not do. John Leader, who represented Glazer, says he hopes this prompts the state to do a better job monitoring these accidents and making the roads safer.
Or at a minimum, providing warnings. The sad reality is that people are still dying on these roadways regularly, and the deaths are preventable.
Glazer will now receive almost $8 million in damages from the state. The Arizona Department of Transportation says it does not have a comment at this time. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This morning, the judge overseeing the contempt of court case against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio gathered all the parties in his courtroom to discuss what's next in the contempt case against the sheriff. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block was there. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Steve.
So there were 4 days of testimony last month in the contempt case against the sheriff and four others. Where do things go from here?
Well, Judge Marie Snow announced in court today that there will be 2 more weeks of contempt hearings in June. So those days in April weren't enough to get through all the material. Plus, the sheriff's office didn't finish handing over documents and completing internal investigations that were supposed to be done before that April hearing. So right now, I mean, it's expected the judge will find that at least the sheriff and Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan are in civil contempt of court because they admitted to that before the hearing. So the real question is what the penalties will be and whether he will refer this for criminal contempt. We're still waiting to find all of that out.
And we've discussed before some of the curveballs that came out of the April hearing, including the revelation that Arpaio had hired a computer consultant in Seattle named Dennis Montgomery to do an investigation that may have had some connection to Judge Snow. Any signs yet about how this revelation is impacting the case?
Well, the details are still really murky about what exactly Montgomery was doing, what he was hired to do. Under testimony, Chief Deputy Sheridan said Montgomery was proving the CIA was hacking into residents' bank accounts and had also evidence that the DOJ was doing surveillance, and possibly that had a connection to Judge Snow. But we still don't really know the details.
And Montgomery has a colorful past?
Right. A number of media reports have discredited him as a scam artist. He sold the U.S. government counterterrorism software in the early 2000s that these reports say was bogus. As for Montgomery's work for the sheriff's office, Sheridan claimed that Montgomery was using CIA data to prove this alleged plot. But it's still unclear if Montgomery really had CIA data. Keep in mind, the sheriff and the chief deputy admitted in court they had doubts about his credibility. But if Montgomery did copy and distribute confidential data, that likely would be a crime.
And when Judge Snow learned about this, he'd ordered the sheriff's office to hand over documents related to the investigation to the court monitor.
Right, because presumably Judge Snow wanted to see how this investigation might relate to the sheriff disobeying the court's authority and other ongoing problems at the sheriff's office. So he wanted to see these documents. But the sheriff's lawyer raised the point in court today that those documents include a giant data dump from Montgomery with sensitive social security numbers and bank account informations of what she said were hundreds of thousands of people. This was apparently on a 2 terabyte hard drive. And we still don't know if this data actually really is from the CIA, and that raises all kinds of complicated issues. So the judge has asked the sheriff's lawyer to write to the head lawyer of the CIA to notify them about this situation and see if they need to intervene in some way.
And you also have a story today on our website that Montgomery himself wants to intervene in the contempt case.
That's right. Montgomery filed a motion last night asking to intervene. He's objecting that his intellectual property was seized by the court, and he says false information was made about him, and he wants to see the judge actually taken off this case.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
Air traffic control systems will be changing in the U.S. over the next several years as part of a program called the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. To get a sense of what the program is and what it'll mean for airports and air travelers, especially at smaller facilities, we turn to Brent Bowen, Dean of the College of Aviation at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott.
NextGen is an upgrade to the air traffic control system. It's been in the works for over a decade, and it's probably going to be another decade before it's completed.
What kind of impact do you expect this to be having on smaller airports? We've heard so much about controversy over flight path changes in and out of Sky Harbor. What kind of impact do you think it might have on smaller airports, of which there are many around the state?
Well, the small airports will have benefits as well as the large airports. However, it's going to be a trickle-down effect. Things are going to be implemented at the most congested airports first, you know, through the airline industry, then into the corporate flying arena, and then into what we call basic general aviation.
So do you expect some of the smaller airports, especially those in the valley that are not that far from neighborhoods, to have similar problems that Sky Harbor has had in some of the neighborhoods around Sky Harbor?
No, not at all. And I would have to say, in my personal opinion, the problem at Sky Harbor is unrelated to NextGen.
What is it related to?
They made a decision to change flight paths to existing arrival and departure routes that weren't being utilized for a long time. And that's why there wasn't any public comment. And it was just a practice in part to, you know, make the departures more efficient, but it wasn't a part of NextGen implementation.
So you mentioned that you expect smaller airports to see some benefits from NextGen. What kinds of benefits might they see?
Well, they'll be seeing technology upgrades for the most part. For example, a field like Prescott, you know, has a very high volume of traffic because of training operations. They'll have more data communications, better voice systems, and the same thing in Tucson, you know, which has a blend of commercial and corporate and general aviation, as well as military aviation. So they'll be getting these technology updates, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years.
Is the new technology that these smaller airports will be getting, is it designed to save them money? Is it designed to be safer, just sort of newer, better technology?
It's designed to be safer and more efficient. It's not necessarily designed for economic benefit, but for safety and overall productivity in the air traffic system.
Brent Bowen is Dean of the College of Aviation at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott. Brent, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport and Falcon Field in Mesa are among the local airports included in NextGen's Metroplex project. Sarah Ferrara, Aviation Planning and Outreach Coordinator for the Scottsdale Airport, says Scottsdale will also be affected.
At this point in time, we have just simply received a notice of intent from the FAA, which means that they're initiating this process. So what we do know is that this is something that the FAA is looking at through for all metropolitan airports across the nation. So for Phoenix, what we've been on notice for is that it's initiating, and it's going to look at aircraft arrival and departure procedures at a number of our airports in this area. So and that includes Scottsdale Airport. So at this point in time, we don't know what that is. We don't know. It may involve aircraft flight path changes, and we just don't know the extent of what that will be at this point. So we received a letter, and of course we responded back because we want to make sure that we have a seat at the table as they're designing these flight paths. We've made a formal request to the FAA to, along with several other major airports, I think that we're all kind of in collaboration at this point in time to have a seat at the table. And we're asking the FAA to conduct significant community outreach to help educate the community.
I think a lot of people think about that sort of, especially touristy time of the year, whether it's Barrett-Jackson, whether it's the Phoenix Open. Is that something that when you have a seat at the table, that would be something you would consider when you're thinking about flight paths, et cetera? You want to make sure that those prime events in Scottsdale are not impacted?
Well, ultimately, the Federal Aviation Administration, they manage and control the airspace. So what we would like is a seat at the table to add our input on any introduced changes, and so that we are there through the process to kind of explain the important things, maybe some of the unique characteristics about Scottsdale Airport, and share that at the table with FAA representatives. So we definitely have a busy season here, and we our main concerns are to protect the interests of the airport and also the needs of our community. We think it's important for us to also be there just to bring forth any of our specific Scottsdale concerns so that they can at least evaluate that as well.
Sarah Ferrara is Aviation Planning and Outreach Coordinator for the Scottsdale Airport. Coming up, scientists use human cadavers to study death and decay in the desert.
People always think, oh, you have DNA technology, that's great, but unless you have something to compare it to, you'll never get an identification.
The second of a two-part series on identifying deceased migrants. That's ahead on the show.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. Quickly checking traffic. I-10 eastbound, an accident at 7th Street has the HOV lane blocked. And on the 60 westbound, an accident at Mill. Look for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 75. Slight chance of rain tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. Partly sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 78. It's 65 degrees at 216.
KJZZ is supported by Bank of Arizona, sharing in the vision of strength and stability of the Arizona business community. Information is available at bankofarizona.com. Member FDIC.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. In what looks like a first for the drug industry in the United States, Johnson & Johnson announced this week that it will assemble an independent group of doctors, ethicists, and patient advocates to evaluate trial drugs for terminally ill patients seeking treatment for their diseases.
It's a decision that may bring clarity to an area of medical practice where the responsibility of companies, regulators, and patients is largely undefined.
Arthur Kaplan, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center, has the job of setting up this task force, which he calls a baby step into a big, important new domain.
I think it's a little bit new. The idea is give advice. We're not the last word. They have the last say. But in looking at how things work now, all too often, people mount social media campaigns to try and plead with a company. Even if they get FDA approval, they will try to call their connected friends, the governor, and so on. The idea of the committee is to say, look, let's have a common pathway. We know there are going to be drugs out there that Johnson & Johnson has that people are going to want. Some of them are in very short supply because they don't make a lot of the drug until they get approval. After people have signed up for trials or aren't eligible for trials or couldn't be in a trial, let everybody come in through a common pathway. Let them then take out identifying information, level the playing field, and then let the panel, with a much broader set of inputs than you get just at the company, try and wrestle with the question of who might get a drug.
There are so many circumstances I can see you being faced with here, Art. And there's the Ebola kind of situation where an experimental drug could save someone who's, you know, infected by something like Ebola. But in an end-of-life circumstance like cancer, if the drug isn't going to cure cancer, aren't you just offering a kind of human guinea pig opportunity for drugs that may extend the life of a cancer patient for some period of months, but not be a so-called cure? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, first, you know, this model of a committee with a broad representation of doctors and some ethicists and some consumer-oriented folks, it might be useful for the Ebola kind of situation, too. Remember, as you said, they do face choices about who to give scarce drugs to. So that was done by who knows who when they were making those decisions. Having a little bit more transparent and public committee might be a better way to go. So we're seeing if that might inspire some of the international organizations or other government bodies. But to get back to your question, yeah, there certainly is no guarantee that something unapproved is going to work. It may not cure. It may extend life. It may be something, sadly, that you don't benefit from. But a lot of people want to try. They are basically looking at a situation saying, I'd like to live to my kid's birthday, or I want to be there for my wife's anniversary. I'm not ready to go. I want a shot. I want to try, and maybe it'll work for me. I wouldn't quarrel with those people's right to think that way and to hope that way. And I think if they want to do it, then they need a fair process to help them have an equal opportunity to take the chance.
All right. So you're head of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center. I mean, a lot of the stories that we do on this program and a lot of the discussions that even you and I have had, Art, are about conflict of interest where doctors and companies are working together. Suddenly you're in the crosshairs here. How do you insulate yourself and your committee from some sort of conflict of interest here?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and it's impossible to build a firewall because Johnson & Johnson is going to pay the expenses and the compensation to committee members. But I tried to set it up this way. I asked that the money go into the medical school, not to the division, certainly not to me. I said I wouldn't be paid. I'm going to chair the committee and I won't vote. I'm just going to try and make it work to try and keep myself out of a conflict. And then the school, once it has the money, I have the budget and I control the committee. It reports to me. So I don't exactly have a firewall between me and Johnson & Johnson, but I've got a kind of a fence. So we do have, I think, persuasive independence on this one.
So assuming there's no negligence, if what Johnson & Johnson gives this patient who gets approval ends up ending their life, are they liability free? How does that work?
Well, it's certainly the case that when you take a novel agent, you are taking risk, and there's always a danger that things can go bad. It isn't clear what the liability is when you voluntarily take a novel unapproved drug, but I will say this. The company's risk is that if someone gets very sick or dies, the FDA, remember we mentioned them, is still in the background watching, and they're going to want to know what happened. So there is risk for the company in giving out new drug, unapproved drugs. It could be held against them. In terms of compensation for a person who may have an untoward outcome using an experimental drug, probably unlikely you'd be able to go to court because there is no standard of care here. You're taking a chance.
Arthur Kaplan, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center, who is tasked to create a panel at Johnson & Johnson to decide trial unapproved drugs for terminally ill patients. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Yesterday, we learned how forensic anthropologists use cadavers donated by American citizens before they die to help researchers in their work identifying deceased migrants. Today, KJZZ's Lorne Madelon describes how a man from El Salvador was identified despite legal obstacles that are the law in the United States.
2012, Central Texas. Forensic anthropologist Kate Spradley at Texas State University gets a phone call from Arizona about a case in Brooks County, Texas.
I was contacted by a colleague at the Calibri Center for Human Rights in Tucson.
The Calibri Center's investigators work in the office of the Pima County Medical Examiner in Tucson. It accepts missing persons reports on lost migrants that U.S. law enforcement routinely won't. The center was calling Spradley about a 20-year-old El Salvadoran named Oscar.
Oscar was traveling with a friend or companion.
His family knew that because the friend called Oscar's relatives in Houston. He told the family Oscar had succumbed to the elements.
Just exhaustion, probably heat exhaustion. And he also hurt his legs, so he had to stay behind, you know. And I can only think of what it's like to leave somebody behind on a journey like this.
Before he was abandoned, the companion noticed Oscar was limping.
And so the companion took a, he was wearing a brown plaid shirt and took it off and wrapped it around Oscar's leg to help him walk. He contacted Oscar's family and told them where they left Oscar and what he was wearing and about the brown plaid shirt around his knee.
After that, Oscar was buried in an unmarked pauper's grave. The family wanted to find him, but couldn't even start a search.
Nobody remembered where Oscar was buried. So there's nothing more to do at that point if you don't know where the body is located.
Then a break in May of 2013, the year after Oscar died. Haley Decker, the Brooks County Sheriff's forensic investigator, picks up the story when university anthropologists joined with forensic investigators to launch a project to identify long-buried migrants.
They went into the cemetery to exhume a lot of these unidentified remains so they could have a proper attempt at identification, mainly skeletal analysis, DNA sampling.
Investigators recovered the bodies of 100 migrants. They didn't know it, but one was Oscar's. His body was brought to Kate Spradley's lab. There, it had been cleaned down to the skeleton so a DNA analysis could be made. Then, says Spradley, the story turned.
I was looking at missing persons reports one day and came across Oscar's missing person report. And that's the first time that I had seen the description of the brown plaid shirt.
That jogged her memory. Her students had just cleaned a brown plaid shirt wrapped around the knee of an unknown man. The shirt's discovery kicked off a chain of events that led to a DNA match. His family's DNA was taken by an Argentine forensic team in El Salvador, then brought to the U.S., and a DNA sample from the skeleton matched DNA from Oscar's family.
He is now waiting to go home. His family has been notified, and he should be repatriated within the month.
Oscar's story is a rarity.
There's multiple obstacles because right now, family reference samples must be collected by U.S. law enforcement. So that's not going to happen for people living in Latin America. People always think, oh, you have DNA technology, that's great, but unless you have something to compare it to, you'll never get an identification.
And even if a migrant has family in the U.S. willing to donate DNA, there's often another challenge.
People who are here unauthorized, they may not want to go to law enforcement to provide a family reference sample. So the obstacles are many.
Spradley is undeterred, though.
We have human rights in life and in death, and everybody has the right to be identified and returned to their family. And the families have the right to know what happened to their loved ones.
Oscar's relatives have told investigators they're grateful for the bittersweet knowledge of what happened to him, knowledge many families never get. Lorne Madelon, KJZZ News, San Marcos, Texas.
The new state budget approved earlier this year includes cuts to career and technical schools called Joint Technical Education Districts, or JTEDs. They serve high school students and offer programs in areas like fire science, cosmetology, and electronics. Like other school districts, JTEDs generally rely on state support, although they also get donations from industry, including equipment. Stephen Welch is Director of Curriculum and Instruction and Student Services for WestMEC, which serves districts in the West Valley.
Like all K-12 public school systems, we certainly have been, you know, handed some challenges in the area of funding over the last couple years. So the JTED model really consists of, WestMEC is a joint technical education district. That model really consists of delivering career and technical education opportunities for students at their local high school campuses, which we call satellite programs. That's really where the bulk of students are served. And then additional students are served through central programs. And those are those programs that are included on our campuses that we run. Those are programs such as aviation, veterinary sciences, medical assisting programs, kind of some real heavy equipment programs.
With the equipment that you mentioned, some of it, I would imagine, is very, very expensive. Do cuts to your budget hurt more than maybe a regular public school district? Because I would imagine that for an aviation class, for example, there are certain machines or devices that you just can't teach the class without having them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, for instance, we know that in Arizona, manufacturing is really kind of one of those silent industries that's just a huge employer in Arizona and growing, a very important sector for the Arizona economy. But to your point, very expensive. When we look at lay mills and CNC machinery, very, very expensive pieces of machinery that a normal K-12 budget would not afford us to be able to provide students that experience.
Well, what are some of the ways you think the budget cuts will manifest themselves? I mean, what might students not be able to do? What might the district not be able to do?
Sure. And of course, it's important to say while we anticipate the budget cuts and we're preparing for the worst, we continue to work collaboratively with our different associations and legislators and business and industry to hopefully bring some kind of ease to these budget cuts. But certainly if the budget cuts are to go through, then it would mean less opportunities for students. We'd probably be looking at less equipment-intensive programs. So, for instance, we might look at a physical therapy assistant program as opposed to a dental hygienist program.
How have you found the enrollment numbers recently? I mean, are students still continuing to want to take these kinds of classes to the levels that they were in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. We're very excited about enrollment and the support of our community. I think community really is starting to see the connection between real skills and, you know, employment opportunities for young people, especially in this era as we read more and more and more about mounting student loan debt and wanting young people to kind of have a pathway free of that debt, and whether that is to go immediately into the workforce, which our programs prepare young people to do with industry certifications, or continue post-secondary opportunities, you know, with a purpose. So it's not career exploration in college, but it's a real, I'm going to college now with a purpose, and I can also, you know, work a different kind of job and make a little extra money.
Stephen Welch is Director of Curriculum and Instruction and Student Services at WestMEC. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Income mobility, or the ability of a family or other group to change its economic status, is the subject of a recent report by two Harvard economists. The pair studied counties all over the U.S. and found that Maricopa County is basically average for income mobility for children in low-income families, better than 48% of other counties. Dan Anderson is Director of Institutional Research for the Arizona Board of Regents and a former economist for the Department of Economic Security. He says there are a number of factors that would separate the income mobility for someone who lives in Maricopa County from, for example, a resident of Pinal County.
Things like the health of the local economies. What types of opportunities are there out there for people to become employed, and what kinds of opportunities those are? It's not just a matter of are there job openings, but are there job openings for people with the skills and education that they need? A number of low-income individuals have low levels of educational attainment, and if they're going to raise their educational attainment, if they're going to raise their income levels, you know, are there jobs that have pathways, if you will, that would move them up the pay scale, or are those positions that, you know, once they're employed in those particular jobs, really cannot expect much in the way of additional earnings in the future?
How important is awareness of the fact that there may be other opportunities available? How much responsibility, I guess, rests with an individual family, and how much rests with government or other entities sort of letting people know there are opportunities?
I think it's a combination of factors. I mean, people move for a lot of different reasons. You know, many people move for what I call the friends and family effect. They move because that's where they have relatives, or that's where they know people who are in that area. Particularly when you're relocating to a new state, I don't usually think the first thing that people think about is, you know, where are my earnings, you know, what county am I going to have the highest earnings in? Obviously, employment opportunities are important, but, you know, if they happen to have someone who they know that's in, let's say, Pinal County, for example, south of the Phoenix area, and they don't know anybody in the Phoenix area, they might be more likely to locate where there's some support structures. And so I would say probably family is one of the most important initial drawing factors. Obviously, there's lots of other people, you know, that need to get involved at the public level and at the private level and educational institutions and others as well.
Considering Maricopa County and Arizona more generally attracts a lot of immigrants, is that something that can create other obstacles too when you have a diverse population?
It sure can. I mean, if you're not able to speak the language, if you're not able to communicate and get to the employers and show the employers the skills you have, that's really going to be a limiting factor. And it's not really just among Hispanics. I'm thinking particularly of Native Americans, for example. Not only is it sometimes are they language barriers, but there are a number of cultural barriers out there as well that can really have an impact. It even has an impact on genders. The kinds of positions that might be available to a male might definitely not be available to a female and vice versa.
There have been times in Arizona, certainly recently with the Great Recession, but at other times where there's been a question about whether elected leaders have devoted enough funding. Is Arizona a state that you think traditionally has spent enough on raising possible opportunities for people in low-income areas?
I think there are lots of opportunities to improve probably the most important resource that we have, and that is our human capital. It's not even a national competition anymore for businesses. It's an international competition. And the greatest resource that any employer has are their employees. When businesses are looking to relocate, the very first question that they're asking is, do you have the workforce that I need? There are lots of other questions and issues in there, but that's the first one. And if we're going to be successful in the years ahead, we really do have to develop the workforce that we have and will have in the future. And again, because of the demographics of the state, that really means that minority populations are the area of the most rapid growth in the state and an area that we have to pay particular attention to.
Dan Anderson, Director of Institutional Research for the Arizona Board of Regents. He's also a former economist for the Department of Economic Security.
Still to come, higher education is getting more expensive in Arizona, but lots of students in the state are leaving financial aid on the table. That's ahead. It's the show.
Updating Valley traffic this afternoon. We're already starting to see some heavy slowing on the Broadway curve. Accidents I-10 eastbound at 7th Avenue. The 60 westbound, a collision at Mill. There's also an accident eastbound at Dobson. Another collision 101 northbound in the East Valley at the 90th Street off-ramp. Expect partly cloudy skies for the rest of this afternoon, then a chance for rain tonight, and overnight lows will be in the mid to upper 50s. Currently relative humidity at 44%. It's partly cloudy and 65 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Fenimore Craig, a full-service law firm collaborating on new business ventures and technology startups for 130 years. FenimoreCraig.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jim Hawk. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister says a five-day ceasefire in Yemen is due to start on Tuesday. Speaking in Paris today, Secretary of State John Kerry commended the move.
Despite the fact that he has had cross-border attacks and other challenges, he has made the decision to try to fight for a peaceful resolution.
The ceasefire will allow the delivery of much-needed humanitarian supplies to the millions of people who've been displaced amid the ongoing violence between Saudi-led forces and Houthi rebels in Yemen. Syrian activists have reported another suspected chlorine gas attack that they blame on the government. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the U.S. is now trying to persuade the U.N. Security Council to take action in response.
The U.N. Security Council already has a resolution on the books banning the use of chlorine as a weapon in Syria, but the council has not agreed on how to assign blame for the attacks, so there's been no response to the repeated allegations. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power says that has to change.
Everybody who has been interviewed has described a correlation between the chlorine-related deaths and the dropping of what appear to be chlorine barrel bombs from helicopters, and as you know, only the regime has helicopters.
She's hoping the Security Council can agree to set up a mechanism to assign blame for such attacks. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
A tropical storm warning has been issued for parts of North and South Carolina nearly a month before the start of the Atlantic hurricane season. What forecasters are calling subtropical storm Anna is expected to bring heavy rain and strong winds to coastal areas. The storm, with sustained winds of 45 miles an hour, is centered about 180 miles south-southeast of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. On Wall Street Friday, the Dow closed up 267, the Nasdaq gained 58. This is NPR.
Many students at Arizona's three public universities will pay more for school next year after the Board of Regents approved tuition and fee increases earlier this month. But not a lot of Arizona students are filling out the form to apply for financial aid from the feds. It's called the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA. The federal government tracks how many students do this and makes that data available. Chad Alderman with the nonprofit Bellwether Education Partners crunched the numbers.
Nationally, about 41% of high school seniors are completing the FAFSA, and in Arizona, that number is less than 27%, so quite a bit less than the national average, and Arizona actually ranks 49th out of all the states right now.
Why do you think that is?
It's hard to tell. I think just hypothetically speaking, I think that there's not much understanding of what the FAFSA is and what it can do. It's free. It's a little bit complicated. There's a lot of questions about financial information of both the student and their parents, and not all students understand that it's a link. The FAFSA is really useful for federal grants and financial aid, state financial aid as well, and also institutional aid.
Do you think that there's a problem of students not knowing either that it exists or that they actually do have to fill it out in order to get federal financial aid?
I think there is a problem, and it's probably multifaceted. I think one thing that's really important to note is that it's really important if you're a high school student to fill out the FAFSA early, because a lot of financial aid are filled out on a first-come, first-served basis. So if students don't fill out the FAFSA and are in a prompt manner, then they might be too late to qualify, or the pool of money that the institution set aside for financial aid has already been allocated to other students.
The fact that so few students in Arizona are filling out this form almost seems counterintuitive, because there's been so much attention paid to tuition increases at the state's public universities. There's a lot of talk about how expensive higher education has gotten in general. So it seems like students would want to fill out this form, and schools, high schools, would encourage them to do so, knowing what higher education costs.
Yeah, it's right. I think that there needs to be more effort to help students fill it out. So I pulled up the latest figures, and in Arizona, about 60% of Arizona's high school students, high school graduates, are going directly into some form of post-secondary education. But you compare that with the FAFSA completion rates, which are only 27% in Arizona, which suggests there's a big gap between the people who are going and are already going to go and the people who have filled out the form and taken the necessary steps to be financially ready to pay for higher education.
It seems like a lot of students are leaving money on the table.
That's right. Nationally, there's an estimate that says that about $2.9 billion is left over in federal grant money that students are leaving on the table. So Arizona has a chunk of that, and students in Arizona are leaving money that they could otherwise be eligible for.
So do you think the answer to this, especially in a place like Arizona, is as simple as high schools need to do a better job of telling their students that they need to fill out this form and what it means?
Yeah, there's a couple things that states can do. The State Department of Education could make it part of their accountability system to say, for a school's rating system, we're going to say FAFSA completion matters, and we're going to incentivize that as part of the way we see high school success. A district could do the same thing. Now they have this data. It's on a weekly basis, so they could check with their schools and their principals, say, how are you doing? And principals, too, could check and see how they're doing on a weekly basis. And that would just incentivize people to pay more attention to this and help students fill out what is a complicated and challenging thing, but which can be something that can be tackled.
Chad Alderman is associate partner with Bellwether Education Partners. He did the research on the completion rates for FAFSA forms among the states. Chad, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The state is trying to get more students to complete the FAFSA forms. Dina Lager is director of State Student Financial Aid for Arizona. She says letting students know about the form is a significant first step.
I think that's the most important piece, is to get the information out there to the students to let them know about the free application for federal student aid and the financial opportunities that it gives them if they fill out that application, to let the Department of Education determine their eligibility for federal grants and loans. And then the schools often, like the universities often, use that FAFSA information to determine the student's eligibility for institutional aid as well.
So what are some of the things that you're working on right now to increase education and also to get people not just knowing about it, but actually following through?
So the Arizona Commission for Postsecondary Education has a website, a Facebook page, and we have a Twitter account. So we're trying to promote the information on social media. And in addition, we've been working with the local community and the high schools. There's an event that's traditionally called College Bowl Sunday that happens in February, and we're trying to expand that, because that traditionally was held at colleges and universities, to encourage people to from the community to come in and get assistance with filling out their FAFSAs from the financial aid officers at those colleges and universities. And this year we had some success with having some of the high schools host their own FAFSA events at their high schools during the daytime and the evening. Mm. That brought in a lot of the high school student population.
How big an impact can this have just by raising, again, the education level?
It can have a huge impact. We've been working, one of our other campaigns that we've been working on is the Arizona College Application Campaign, and we've been trying to promote how important it is to fill out an application for college. And we've seen that a lot of times through this campaign, students are applying for college for the very first time. And this last fall, we had 21% of our students fill out a college application for the very first time at this event. And when we ran through those numbers about the students who are applying for the very first time, and the majority of those students are Pell eligible students, which means that's the free federal grant that the student would qualify for if they filled out the FAFSA application. The numbers based off of those students, if we only took half of them who received a federal Pell grant and went on to college, that could boost our economy by $4.7 million. I think we came up with, 2,700 seniors filled out a college application for the very first time through these college application events this last fall. And so if we just did half of those students who received the Pell grant and went on to college this upcoming fall, that would bring in $4.7 million in Pell grant for those students.
Dina Lager is Director of State Student Financial Aid for Arizona.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. We're bringing you more of our community mix with national stories and international news.
KJZZ is supported by High Health. You can drink your daily vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants. Introducing Tropical Fruit Flavor Optum Nutrition Liquid Whole Food and Vegetable Multivitamin. Now at 42 High Health stores and highhealth.com.
Is the era of retirement over? It's the startling conclusion that's fast becoming a consensus. A recent survey shows more than half of the workforce intends to stay on the job once they reach retirement age, and that's mainly because they have to. The BBC's Matt Wells has been finding out why the retirement dream seems to be dying.
A lean, gray-whiskered busker sits outside the state legislature of New Mexico, crumpled notes nestling inside a battered cowboy hat on the ground. Like many of retirement age in this still fragile economy, he's not doing this just to pass the time. As far as Professor Teresa Gilarducci is concerned, from the New School for Social Research in New York, retirement now is only really for the lucky few.
There was a reason why we had retirement in the first place, because people got worn out from their jobs. It made sense economically for the employer to put them out to pasture. That's from the employer's point of view. And it made sense from the worker, who lived all their life in a growing, richer economy, to spend some of that prosperity on their own leisure time. And we're finding in America a reversal.
So what does retirement really mean these days in America? Well, I've come to the outskirts of the city of Albuquerque in New Mexico to talk to a range of people who are of retirement age, but are finding that retirement itself means something very different from how it looked about 20 or 30 years ago.
Be right with you.
Here at the American RV Park, many live as so-called work campers. A free spot for motorhomes or RVs, recreational vehicles, is provided in exchange for an average 18-hour work week. It's a magnet for older couples. They do all the basic jobs around the large site, from manning the cash register in the shop to guiding in camper vans.
That's our little moose.
This is our humble abode.
Denny Hayes and Maggie Groban are at either end of their 60s. They love the sense of community that caravanning and work camping offers, but staying healthy now is a priority.
I was in jobs where we really had no retirement plan, so I just depend on my Social Security and the work camping money I make, and we get by and we're happy.
Have you met people on the road who don't have any safety net, who are really living from week to week?
Oh, week to week. Yeah. I think there's a lot of them out there that do that.
I think the government should be helping Americans more.
So are we really talking about the end of retirement, the death of retirement, if I can use that phrase?
Yeah, I believe that 30 years down the road or 40 years down the road, there's not going to be any. And what do those people do then? What is this world going to come to? I mean, is it going to be a Mad Max at that point? Or a lot of people aren't going to be able to even buy food.
A grim future may be in the offing then for the generation to come, but Professor Gilarducci warns that pensioners who have to keep working now also constitute a growing crisis.
Even though some retirees are able to find a low-wage job and actually work in them, many more are not going to be able to even find a bad job. And if they do have a bad job, it'll take 2, 3, 4 months before some illness or injury get them off. And then what? We're seeing here, with our numbers, the fastest growing group of people in poverty are going to be older people. And we thought we had licked that problem.
Come on in, no
Thanks
problem.
Thanks so much, hi.
It wasn't your problem.
Bud and Kay Alexander welcome me inside their RV with a cup of late morning coffee. He's 80, and although he's finally left the building site, they work more hours than most around here. Like many American couples, their retirement nest egg got wiped out by the financial crash. They're at the mercy of dwindling government support.
And it all just boom, 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 you know. I got fighting mad. You know, when they're pulling, they're just stealing my money, you know. And I don't know who they are. I'd like to find them and talk to them. We kind of blew it like a lot of people, you know, and didn't really plan real serious for it. If nothing happens, this is home.
That's the BBC's Matt Wells.
He's been depicted in Hollywood films by well-known actors and is a big part of Arizona folklore. But despite his fame, we have for decades misidentified him. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez has more.
I myself was a dentist. I was proud to be a dentist. I did not hide the fact that I was a dentist. How are your teeth?
Many film critics and historians agree the portrayal of Doc Holliday in the 1994 film Wyatt Earp is one of the most realistic interpretations of him. He was a tall Georgia man with a southern drawl and very ill.
In Georgia, we were taught that a man should take pride in his work.
But did you know the Doc Holliday image we've come to know through items and souvenirs is really not him?
If you go on the internet and Google Doc Holliday, you'll find 8 or 9 pictures of that say it's Doc Holliday, and only 2 are correct.
Marshall Trimble is the Arizona State historian. He says one of those pictures is when he graduated dental school.
It doesn't look like a gunfighter at all. And then the one that was 1879, when he would have been in his early 30s, and it's so grainy you can't even tell who it is.
Doc Holliday's real name was John Henry Holliday. He came to Arizona in the late 1870s. Trimble says Doc Holliday was known to pack a knife and pistol, mostly because he was so sick with tuberculosis he could barely hold up his fists to fight. His passion was gambling. Holliday came to Arizona to help the Earp brothers keep the peace in Cochise County during a time when ranchers and cattle rustlers were often at odds. But Holliday only stayed in Arizona for 3 years. Yep, you guessed it. He left right after the gunfight near the OK Corral.
It's just funny that as famous as he was at the time, there aren't more photographs.
But this hasn't stopped some people from claiming there are. Trimble says the other photographs on the web are of another Arizona man named John Escapule.
It is a very popular picture that's out there on the sales racks in curio stores and Old West stores. And the thing is we know who John Escapule was. He was in Tombstone, so he's got to be well known. But somebody just said later on, you know, years later, said that's Doc Holliday.
Trimble says even worse than misidentifying Doc Holliday is not knowing where he's buried. After the Tombstone gunfight, Holliday settled in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and died there in 1887. Some say his burial site was lost. Others say the family in Georgia claimed his body and buried him back home. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you know things that we should know, please tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org. No need to adjust your radio. That sound is not coming from this station. It was actually recorded 22 miles above the Earth. Along with a team from NASA, the National Science Foundation, and others, Daniel Bowman got the recording and sped it up so humans could hear it. Bowman is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of North Carolina.
Well, I've, for the last couple of years, have been very interested in trying sound recordings in the atmosphere. So when I got an announcement from NASA that they were looking for student projects to put on a high-altitude balloon as part of the high-altitude student platform, I thought, well, here's my chance to test my idea that by flying high above the Earth's surface, you would hear not only sounds better, but sounds maybe we'd never heard before. So I used some infrasound microphones that a professor at Boise State University named Jeff Johnson built, and put them on the balloon along with several other student projects. And when we recovered the payload and downloaded the sound files, that's what we found.
So it sounded a little bit to me like radio static, like if you're in between frequencies where there is a station. How do you describe the sound?
Yeah, I think that's a good characterization. There's bursts of kind of static-like sound, and then you can hear in the recording some kind of pure tones, and then a few kind of clicks and whistles. The static-like sound is basically like white noise, and then the pure tones, you know, I can go into what we think is causing them. Some of them could be simply the cables on the balloon vibrating, although not all of them are probably that. So the complexity of the signal is the struggle at this point.
When I first read about this, the first thing I thought about was that Jodie Foster movie, Contact, where they're, you know, looking for, for signs from outer space. It sounds like your description, based on this, this is not that.
No, you know, sound can't travel through outer space, despite what myriads of science fiction movies will tell us with spacecraft exploding and lasers making sound. That really doesn't happen. Sound requires a medium like air or water or earth to travel through.
So in addition to cables on the balloon that the recorder was on, what are some of the other hypotheses that you have of what's making the sound?
Commercial aircraft are certainly contributing, or I shouldn't say certainly, are most likely contributing to some of those pure tone signals that you hear as they pass by underneath the balloon. We did fly over a wind farm, and wind farms are known to produce infrasound. And also, a colleague of mine at Sandia National Laboratories and I did some very kind of ad hoc infrasound measurements inside buildings and realized that one of the signals we're picking up on the balloon might in fact be air conditioners in Albuquerque. My personal opinion, and in fact, just before you called me, I'm wading through the literature to see if that opinion pans out, is that those staticky bursts are possibly turbulence.
So what do you hope to learn from the recordings that you've gathered?
Well, the atmosphere in that region actually gathers sound from all over the planet based on the structure of the atmosphere. Sound waves tend to get trapped up there. So, you know, first of all, we want to know what's making it up there and what's staying up there. There's models that tell us how sound moves through that region, but we have no constraints on them without direct observation. Another thing I'm interested in is how much energy is traveling in sound waves from the surface of the Earth to the top of the atmosphere? And the reason that's important is because that energy is deposited up there as heat, which perturbs the upper atmosphere, which conceivably can have effects on satellites and other objects that are way high up.
Daniel Bowman is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of North Carolina. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Phoenix Herpetological Society will soon be home to 10 freshwater crocodiles, a rarity in the United States.
The crocs are flying to Phoenix as we speak, soon to complete a long journey from the Frankfurt Zoo in Germany. The show's Annika Klein has more.
The crocodile hunter was friend to the freshwater crocodile in his day.
I've never seen a female freshie attack a person before. She's guarding her eggs.
Nicknamed freshies, these crocs can run at speeds up to 18 miles per hour, and their sharp teeth are nothing to mess with. But that hasn't stopped them from becoming a threatened species due to hunting and other reasons. Phoenix Herpetological Society President Russ Johnson says that on top of that, the crocs have seldom been imported into the U.S., so when the reptile sanctuary learned that the Frankfurt Zoo bred a surplus of these crocs, Johnson says they took the lot.
And so we're excited because this will give us a chance to grow these up and possibly produce some of these, which would make them available for zoos across the United States.
The sanctuary will house the freshies in a climate-controlled enclosure where they'll grow from 20-inch babies to 5-foot-long adults. But they'll be small for a while, Johnson says.
They're very slow growers. So right now, there's the cute factor.
The crocodiles will be on display on Monday, or you can attend the Phoenix Herpetological Society's Twilight Croc Walk on May 16th. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Well, the weekend is almost getting ready to start, and a lot of things for you to do. The metal rock band Flotsam and Jetsam playing tonight at Club Red in Mesa. One thing, Mark, that stands out to me.
Yeah.
A metal rock band, the concert starts at 6. Seems like they have to get to bed early.
Way too early. You can also check out the Moody Blues. They'll be playing tonight at Talking Stick Resort.
Diamondbacks are hosting the Padres all weekend at Chase Field. Tonight at 6:40, tomorrow 5:10, Sunday at 1:10.
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof will be performed at Mesa Community College Theater. That's tonight and tomorrow afternoon.
Was that your nickname as a teenager?
No, okay. Definitely not.
And if you're a pro wrestling fan from the 80s, Jake the Snake Roberts brings his Unspoken Word Tour tonight at 10 to Improv Mania in Chandler.
And we should also mention Sunday, obviously Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day both to Mrs. Goldstein and to my mom. My mom doesn't live here, so she can't listen, but happy Mother's
Day nonetheless. Mrs. Brody, in case you were wondering.
Right. Happy Mother's Day nonetheless. The show is produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer, John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. You can reach us, the show, at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. If you didn't get the message already, we hope you have a wonderful weekend. It's 3 o'clock.